Good morning. It is 10:26, Wednesday, October 28th. This is the TDN Writers Room presented by Keeneland. My name is Joe Bianca. I'm the associate editor of the Thoroughbred Daily News. And if John is pitching a lights out game, I'm not going to take him out too early.
I am Bill Finley, a correspondent for the Thoroughbred Daily News. And speaking of the World Series, congratulations to the Dodgers and Mookie Betts. And may the Red Sox owners rot in hell for letting the greatest player in my lifetime get away.
Jonathan Green, general manager for DJ Stable. And I was looking back at my high school track numbers, and Andy Byers gave me a negative 14 during my 100-meter sprint.
Alan Grasso, managing editor of the TDN. And I said last week, told somebody the Chicago Bears are the worst 5-1 team in football. Now they're the worst 5-2 team in football. And I'm predicting, we can watch this back in 9 weeks' time, the Bears will not finish better than 8-8. You heard it here first.
Typical Chicago fan optimism from Al.
Very nice. Realism, Joe. Realism.
I think you're probably right. And Bill, you got a World Series out of Mookie, so I wouldn't be too sad about it.
Okay.
TDN Writers Room is presented by Keeneland. Reminder that Keeneland November with 3,777 offerings plus supplementals in the catalog starts November 9th. That'll be right after the Breeders' Cup, November 6th and 7th. The clock is ticking. We're about a week and a half away from the Breeders' Cup. Lots to talk about the pre-entries and the entries to come. And we look forward to Keeneland November as well. Should be a great couple weeks down in Lexington. And hopefully the weather works out and everything is smooth. We think Keeneland's doing all they can, COVID protocols and such. So we're looking forward to all that action coming up at Keeneland. So today the Breeders' Cup pre-entries came out at long last. Over 200 horses entered in the 14 Breeders' Cup races. We'll get final entries next week, and that's when we'll do the really deep dive on the different fields. But just wanted to do a little quick first blush impression of these races. But before we get into that, I wanted to ask Bill, who was just on the Breeders' Cup teleconference, if there was any news to come out of that.
Yeah, Joe, there was actually some news, and I was kind of surprised by this, but Brad Cox, the trainer of Monomoy Girl, raised the possibility that she could race next year. Of course, she's in the face of Tipton Sale, and as far as I know, or anybody else knew, this was going to be the last race of her career. He didn't say she would definitely run. He said that he thought the plan was after the Breeders' Cup, everybody would sit down and discuss it. Now, if she were to race next year, she would be six, but remember, she missed her whole four-year-old year, so it's not quite the same as a horse going to a six-year-old season. And he said a lot will depend on what happens in the Breeders' Cup. You know, whether they want to put her through the sales ring and have a big RNA on her. That's a possibility, I suppose. Or just pulling her out of the sales, a possibility. Or just going ahead and selling her is a possibility. But I thought that was a pretty exciting revelation from Brad Cox. I don't think anybody expected that we would have her back for a six-year-old year. So we'll see what happens with that. And speaking of superstar Philly, Swiss Skydivers trainer Kenny McPeak was on. He pre-entered the horse for both the Distaff and the Classic, first preference to the Distaff. He still is non-committal about where she will run, but he hinted that it will be the Distaff. He used terms like it's the more logical place to go and things like that. He also said that it's unlikely that they're going to let the decision wait till the last minute. He says what he wants to do now is sit down with owner Peter Callahan and just sort of go over the pluses and minuses of both races. And he is very aware that the Classic is a really deep, tough race. And not to beat him, Monomoy Girl, anybody else in the Distaff will be easy. But I wouldn't say it's definite either way. But at this point, you're looking for little hints. And I think Kenny McPeak was hinting that the Distaff would be the place for Swiss Skydiver to go.
Bill, did McPeak say anything about a rider?
No, why wouldn't it be Robbie Alvarado?
I assume it would, because he's burned his bridges with everybody else. So that's why I was just wanted to make sure he was actually going to stay on with Robbie. He did nothing wrong to warrant being taken off.
I mean, that question was not raised, but I don't think there's any doubt who will ride the horse, especially after the Preakness. You know, how could you possibly take him off all the things that conspired to get him the mount and as good a race as he rode?
Well, I think that's an interesting segue, because I wanted for us to talk about the Distaff and the Classic, and then we'll pepper in a little bit of discussion about the other fields. But that's the decision that both of those fields are hinging on, is the Swiss Skydiver decision. Now, it matters, I think, materially to the result of the race more in the Distaff than the Classic. But for Horse of the Year purposes, I think it matters, you know, more if she goes in the Classic, because then I think she's really going for Horse of the Year with her. But definitely adds a lot of juice to the Distaff, because, you know, the Distaff, we were talking all year about what a great division it is and how many good three-year-old fillies could possibly take their shot. But you look at the actual pre-entries and they're really, you know, Gamine's turning back. I mean, without Swiss Skydiver, you don't have Speech in there. You have like CC, Harvest Moon, Harvey's a little Goyle, second preference. I mean, it's not a terrific field, but if you get that matchup between Swiss Skydiver and Monomoy Girl, I think that is something that people are going to pay to see. So I think that makes it a much more interesting race if she does indeed go with the first preference and go into the distaff. The Classic definitely looks like a deeper race. We've got Authentic and we've got Tisla, obviously the heavy hitting 3-year-olds, but then Maximum Security and Improbable as well. So yeah, I mean, it sucks not, and Tom Seitel as well. I mean, it would suck not to have that kind of juice of having a filly going against the boys again in the Classic, but I think it adds more juice to the distaff. Just general thoughts from you guys about those two fields potentially.
Well, Joe, I think you're right. I mean, first of all, you look at the horse of the year picture. If Swiss Skydiver to run in the Classic and win, obviously she'd be horse of the year. It would be interesting though, what if she runs in the distaff and wins? And then you have the scenario, well, okay, if a 20-1 shot wins the Classic, she would almost definitely be horse of the year. But I'm wondering, even if a horse like Improbable wins the Breeders' Cup Classic and Swiss Skydiver wins the distaff, wouldn't there be some people that would look at the bulk of her work in this amazing campaign and all the races she's run in and say, look, you know, the horse of the year definition really is from January to December, and she was the horse of the year. You know, I don't know how I'd vote myself. I'd have to give that a sec, give that some real thought. But, you know, I think you can make a case that if she wins the distaff, she's certainly in the argument. But I think people would lean more towards the Classic winner as long as it's one of the three or four favorites in the race. But I'm hoping she goes in the distaff myself, because like you said, the Classic has all the pizzazz it needs. I mean, if she doesn't run in the distaff, you kind of have Monomoy Girl as an odds-on favorite in a race that everybody's going to expect her to win without much competition. So I think if she goes in the distaff, you have two great races on the card. Well, you have plenty of great races, but the two real highlights are going to be the distaff with the showdown between Swiss Skydiver and Monomoy Girl and this very, very deep Classic with all the Baffert horses, Tis the Law, Tom's the Tot, just a race that really looks like it's going to be one of the better Breeders' Cup Classics we've seen in a long time.
Yeah, I'm very excited to see the Breeders' Cup Classic for that exact reason, with or without Swiss Skydiver. I think that you can make a case for a majority of the horses in the race. Obviously, post-position is going to be of great interest to me once they draw next week, but it's a very solid group. And the distaff, it's interesting because there's 11 pre-entered horses, but it could be down to 9 horses, depending on how things shake out for a couple of horses like Harvey's Little Goyle. I just like saying her name, but Harvey's Little Goyle looks like she's going to run in the turf race. That's her first preference. And, you know, the decision that that Team McPeak have to make with Swiss Skydiver. I don't remember a small field like that happening in recent times. What's interesting also to me is when you look at our broader scale, and I don't want to jump the gun on this because I know Alan wants to talk about these two races. But when you look at how many 2-year-olds are in the respective 2-year-old races, and a couple of the races are almost 24 horses pre-entered, all the way, you know, up the pyramid to the more, the higher purse monies and the distaff and the Classic, it's almost like a pyramid. It almost goes, you know, from 23 or 24 horses pre-entered down to 11 or maybe even 9 in the distaff, depending on how things look. So, there definitely is more excitement as far as depth of field for the 2-year-old races. And it may just be that, you know, one of the things we talk about all the time is horses retiring early, that there's just not a lot of horses at the top of the pyramid. But it seems like there's a lot of quality at the top of the pyramid.
Yeah, Joe, I kind of hope, like you mentioned Tom Seitel almost parenthetically and almost as an afterthought. I kind of hope that's what happens on Breeders' Cup Day. It'll be interesting to see how the bettors handle him, given the time he's been off and that others have been in training and running since then. I think he's got every chance it's going to set up for a horse with his style. And assuming he leaves the gate there running, I think he's got every chance. John, I don't think the post position is that big of a deal going 10 furlongs at Keeneland. You've got a pretty significant run to the first turn and plenty of time to sort themselves out there. Even with a 10 horse field, I'm not sure that's going to be that big of a deal. And I agree, the Monomoy Girl versus Swiss Skydiver, those are the type of matchups that you want to get in the Breeders' Cup. But I think it goes beyond them. I think the race goes through either one of them. But CC's high quality, Point of Honor is classes up well. Valiance showed that she could be a dirt horse last time in the Spinster. So, I think it's maybe deeper than maybe it looks on paper.
And Horologist even, as well.
I was just going to say, we haven't even mentioned Horologist, who had the pony of a lot of money to run in this race. Go ahead, Jeff.
Just one last thought about the Classic. I agree with you guys that it's one of the strongest fields in a while. And just going through last year's field and, you know, Vino Rosso, McKenzie, Higher Power, Elite, Math Wizard, Seeking the Soul, Code of Honor, Yoshida, War of Will, Owendale. Like, there's some good horses in there, but how many of those horses would be less than 10-1 in this year's Breeders' Cup? 2-3 maybe. So I think, you know, it has so more pizzazz this year, especially with the three-year-olds, like the really top class three-year-olds going up against some really nice older horses as well. So yeah,
that's a really good point. That's a really good point, Joe. You're exactly right. If you look back at last year's, it'd be hard to make a case for a lot of them.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's what you want in a classic. It's the finale of the whole event. So seems like it's gonna live up to the billing this year. I just wanted to move on and just touch on some other races briefly. The Juvenile Fillies, I think, is one of the shorter fields. John was talking about the big groups in the juvenile races, which he's right about, except for the Juvenile Fillies, which I think has 8 horses entered and 2 horses with second preference. So assuming it stays 8 horses, it's a pretty short field, but I think it's pretty top heavy. And I think it's a really interesting race where you can make a case for 4 or 5 of the horses, and champion two-year-old filly is completely up for grabs. Of course, Princess Nora, we're going to talk to Andy Beyer later about, you know, kind of a low figure horse, but a big hype horse who I think is going to take a bunch of money. But she's got a lot of competition and Simply Ravishing. Day Out of the Office was really good in the Frisette. We talked about her. Girl Daddy looked really good in the Pocahontas, and as well as Thoughtfully, who won the Adirondack, Bequist, who won the Spinaway. So short field, but a really, really nice looking field at 2-year-old fillies, and I think is one of the most fascinating races of the 2 days. The Mile, I think, is a super fascinating race and might be one of the best races of the whole day on Saturday. The Big Ass Fans Dirt, I'm going to get to the Mile in a second. The Big Ass Fans Dirt Mile, just wanted to pump that in real quick. It's kind of a race that's going to be, I think, a little eviscerated by first preference horses, because if you go through the field, I mean, you have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, so you have 14 main body or 12 main body horses and then another 12 also eligibles. Juan Raison has first preference in the sprint. CC Rocket has first preference in the sprint. Global Campaign has first preference in the classic. Hog Creek Hustle, first preference in the sprint. So it's a lot of horses. Vekoma has first preference in the sprint. So Nashville, first preference in the sprint. So I think it's the Dirt Mile is kind of going to be a little bit eviscerated by those. But you'll still have Art Collector. You still have Complexity. So I think there's still a couple interesting horses. But once the rest of those horses disperse to those other races, I don't think it's quite as interesting. But the Breeders' Cup Mile, I think, is going to be a terrific race. You know, on the American side, you got Uni, who won it last year. You got Ivar, who won the Shadwell Turf Mile. Halliday, who won the 4-star Dave. So you got a handful of grade one winners going into the mile. But the horses that I think are really interesting are the ones that are coming from overseas. Circus Maximus won the Queen Anne for Aidan O'Brien. You also got One Master, who's won the Prix de la Forêt 3 times in a row at Longchamp. He's going to be coming over. But so I think that's a really interesting clash of coasts, which is one of the things that we look for in the Breeders' Cup. We lost a contender over the weekend with Mo Forza bowing out, but still a lot of nice American horses going against a lot of nice European horses. And that's what I'm looking forward to the most. I'll toss it over to John right now. I know he's got a couple ideas.
Yeah, I've been watching very closely a lot of the 2-year-old turf races, both here and abroad. Just with the idea of you know, seeing how the competition would look against some of our horses coming up. And, you know, 2 races that really stood out on that front was one was the Breeders' Cup Juvenile Turf presented by Coolmore. There were actually 23 horses pre-entered. I mean, there were so many in there that you could, you know, not that they would do this, but you can make a case they would split the race. There were so many horses of interest. You have a Barta, who's an Into Mischief, ran second in the Bourbon at Keeneland. You know, you have Battleground, who's the Warfront colt that is coming over from Europe for Aidan O'Brien that hasn't run since July, but could be the prohibitive favorite based on that horse's you know, classic PPs. Fire at Will, who won the Pilgrim at Belmont. Gritsy the Great, obviously a big winner up in an undefeated horse up in Canada. That's Mark Cassie Nyquist colt. And then, you know, Out a Door, who I thought was a very interesting Wesley Ward horse that that got in, that has, you know, shown some very, very fast fractions. And, you know, maybe the, you wonder about the two turn mile, if that's going to, you know, be OK with him. But, you know, again, showing typical early speed that Wesley Ward usually likes to show. Interestingly enough, the way the field is put together, you know, there's five winning your ins in this race. And then there were two more taken in based on the top points. That's half the field. And then the other half of the field is voted upon. And in order to make this race as international as possible, it looks like the voters decided to take five of the seven horses that were voted in are European horses. So they really wanted to make sure that they brought the world's best turf horses from all over, you know, all over God's green earth in order, you know, to fill the, that race's field. And it looks like a good race. Quickly, you know, you look at the girl version of it, the Breeders' Cup Juvenile Turf. You have Aunt Pearl, who was the expensive horse that Brad Cox trains that won the Jessamine very impressively at Keeneland. And Mother Earth is a horse that I've personally been following. And Alan and I have spoken off air about this filly, the Zoffany filly coming in from Europe for Magner and Tabor and Aidan O'Brien, you know, training. Royally, royally bred filly. Looks like she had a bad race last time out, but before then had reeled off a really impressive early juvenile, you know, 2-year-old career. And she's going to be an interesting Euro that's coming in. And then Plum Ali, who's a late running horse of Clement's, that also is going to, I think, you know, do very well in this race. And then one more turf race, you know, that I thought was of great interest was the Turf Sprint. And again, a deep field, but the two that stood out to me, one was Got Stormy, the filly who is going to try to run against the boys. She won last time out in the Franklin County at Keeneland going 5.5. I think she really wants to go further. Obviously she's run and won going much, much further. But this was the best, you know, spot for her, and she's going to take on the men. And Imprimis, who is trained by Joe Orsino. The horse loves Keeneland, you know, and won the Shakertown last year at Keeneland. And I think if he gets an outside post, he could really be dangerous in that race. But again, another deep field on the turf, you know, for the upcoming Breeders' Cup.
I was zeroing in a horse in the for the Dirt Mile, and that horse is not in the field, and that is Code of Honor.
Good point.
I'm not aware of any injury. I haven't heard of anything. I don't know if you guys heard anything, but I thought he could be dangerous in there. I thought he could improve, actually. Get a setup and go in the 2-turn mile. I thought he could be interesting, but not among the entries.
Well, it's interesting too, because if he wanted to go in the Cigar Mile, he's got Performer now. Shug does right. For that race as well. Right. So
Good point. Alan, if you want to book that bet, if you want to bet Code of Honor in the Breeders' Cup, I'll bank it for you.
Will you? This is what makes you a financial genius, Green.
Why I'm here. I'm here to help you, buddy.
Green Group is getting into bookie services now. Did you hear?
Joe, two other horses in the mile, the European Invaders, 3-year-olds. Siskin is going to be very tough. And then a fellow Guineas winner, Kamiko by Kins Joy, both American breds. Siskin by First Defense. Junmon Horse is going to retire to stud in Japan after this. And Kamiko, who's looks best at a mile, he's out of a mare called Sweeter Still. So I think those two are interesting in that race. I'd like to transition to the turf, if that's okay. With there's 11 horses in the body of the field, and I think I saw a tweet that John Gosden is going to run. Got to find her name here. Where are you here? Medayi, forgive me for my pronunciation, but she's going to go in the turf. There are 11 horses pre-entered in the race, and 5 of them are females, which I find interesting. And it really looks like the Europeans have a stranglehold on this race. Magical has done nothing wrong this year. She beat a horse called Sir Dragon A in the Tattersall's Gold Cup over the summer. He came back and won the Cox Plate last weekend in Australia. She won the Irish Champion Stakes at Leopardstown. She beat Gaiath on the square that day. Guy was intended runner in this race, but is not coming. So she'll take all the beating. Mogul's a 3-year-old, won the Grand Prix de Paris for Aidan O'Brien. O'Brien's won the race 5 times. He's won with 3-year-olds. Found the last time the race was at Keeneland in 2015. She beat Golden Horn, big favorite, and Magician won as a 3-year-old at San Anita. So he knows how to get the job done there. Our horses look to be a cup below. Channel Maker is racing in the Breeders' Cup for the 4th time in his career, going all the way back to the Juvenile Turf 4 or 5 years ago. And then you have United, second last year to Bricks and Mortar, but sure looks to me like the race goes through the Euros there.
Yeah, I totally agree, Al, that the Breeders' Cup Turf, I think, runs through the Euros. I think the mile, we have a couple other better shots, but and the juvenile races, I think we got a couple other better shots. But yeah, other than Channel Maker, I wouldn't hang my hat on any of the Americans in the Breeders' Cup Turf. But so good initial thoughts from everybody. We'll have the entries, like I said, next week, and then we'll kind of go through it race by race with all the fields and the post positions and such, and maybe even a couple of wagering strategies as well. So thanks to everybody for their input, and we'll talk more next week about it. Owning multiple graded stakes winning racehorses like Hard Not to Love and Decorated Invader is attainable with a racing partnership like West Point Thoroughbreds. Partnerships enable you to spread your ownership across several horses for less than it costs to own one horse alone. This increases your racetrack action and chances for a big horse. Learn more about why West Point Thoroughbreds is the gold standard in racing partnerships at westpointtv.com. So not a ton of news going on this week. With the Breeders' Cup coming up, we kind of hit a lull a little bit in terms of racing. But we have drug news, and there's always drug news in racing if you look hard enough. So a couple stories this week, in the past week, but the main one revolves around Bob Baffert. He had Gamine test positive in the Oaks for betamethasone, which is a corticosteroid anti-inflammatory. She ran third in the Oaks. And then yesterday it was reported that Merneith, who's a 3-year-old filly for him, tested positive for a cough suppressant. So this is a couple more red flags here. Bob Baffert has said that these are, through his attorney, has said that these are contamination positives. CHRB has yet to adjudicate and rule on this. It's a tough situation because, you know, there hasn't been like this big explosive like positive for Bob Baffert that's like, okay, here it is. Here's the smoking gun. He's a cheater, all this stuff. It's been like these little possibly explainable issues along the way. With Gamine, it's like it becomes a bigger issue because she's such a huge name and such a star in the sport. And she has had these big blowout wins. She won by 18 3/4 lengths in the Acorn, had that big win in the test. As far as we know, she hasn't tested positive for anything in either of those two races. So take that for what it's worth. But it's just when it's a big name like Baffert and Gamine, it's obviously going to attract a lot of reporting. Joe Draper, the New York Times, does a lot of reporting on Bob Baffert and these horses. But you pair that up with the Justify thing. But at the end of the day, at the least, he's kind of he's responsible for his barn and what goes on in his barn. And whether or not there was something untoward happening, it's not for me to say, but at the very least, I think he needs to run a little bit of a tighter ship, because this is happening far too often for someone who's at the top of the game and has all of these terrific racehorses that we love watching race. I mean, at best, he's been a little bit of a sloppy manager with his stable, and it's kind of unacceptable for a guy who's that big and has so much of racing's reputation in his hands with these high level, you know, big high profile horses. So curious to get your guys' thoughts on it. We'll start with Bill.
Well, Joe, I think I feel exactly the same way you do. First of all, I do think it's important to mention that, at least this is my opinion, the people are saying throw the guy out of the sport. No, that's not right. People are saying this is the latest after a service in Navarro. I don't agree with that at all. I don't think this is Bob Baffert giving Monkey or Red Devil or SGF 1000, the drugs that these guys were allegedly giving to their horses, in a clear attempt to improve their performance. It doesn't seem to be the case here. So I think to paint Baffert with the same broad brush of Navarro service and fill in the blanks of the other 10, 15 guys we all are very suspicious of that are juicing their horses is inaccurate. But I would just second what you said here. He's got to do a better job here. This is not right, and it's not okay. He has given racing a black eye at a time where racing can ill afford it. And, you know, why does it keep happening to him? You know, this doesn't happen to Shug McGahee. It doesn't happen to Todd Pletcher. It doesn't happen to Chad Brown. It doesn't happen to Graham Motion. As you mentioned, this is really the fourth incident we've had over the last couple of years, starting with Justify with the Scopolamine and the Jimson Reed and all that. You then have Gamine and Charlatan, one. You have Gamine, two. And now this. What is going wrong here? What is this guy doing? And yeah, I'm willing to give him the benefit of the doubt that he is sloppy, but that's not okay. This never should have happened in the first place, and it damn well better not happen again, because he's got to realize that it's not just his reputation, which has taken a hit here. It is the reputation of the sport where he makes his living and professes to love. And he's got to dig down deep, find out what's going on here, and correct whatever the problem is with his barn. There can't be a number five of this. Four is way too much. One is way too much. You know, Bob, let's get your act together and stop.
Yeah, and like it or not, he's the face of racing worldwide. I mean, he's successful. He's in, you know, one of the biggest markets, media markets in the world out in California. He runs horses everywhere. He wins races everywhere. You know, he's got the iconic white hair. I mean, he is the, when people ask about, I mean, they find out I'm in racing, you know, they say, number one, have you ever been to the Kentucky Derby? And number two, what's Bob Baffert like? And it's because he's so top of the head with people outside of the industry that's where they go to. And he's a gravitating figure. I mean, we had him on an interview here. He's a nice guy. He's a good guy. He's very intelligent. He's very down to earth, and he represents the industry well, from a media standpoint. But from a business standpoint, if we're going the route of, hey, he's just not a great manager of people, or he's not a great hirer of people, then that's a whole different story. And I don't know if I can give him that benefit of the doubt. So he should have pick of the litter of the top exercise riders, grooms, and hot walkers, et cetera, to the point where, you know, these people should be professionals and should know that if they're sick, they can't come in on DayQuil, NyQuil, Robitussin, you know, whatever, fill in the blank. So I kind of think it's circumstantial at best that you know, he's having these issues with his employees as well.
By the way, John, in this group here, this fourth of them, I am the guy with the iconic white hair.
You have to have hair to have white hair, Alan.
It's there, trust me.
Okay, all right.
My problem with this whole thing, and I agree with everything, this is the ultimate insurer thing. So the buck has to stop with the boss. So Bob Baffert's Harry Truman here. He's got to bear the responsibility for it. I don't like the argument that goes a horse tested at 27 picograms, which is one trillionth of a gram, and so the rules are bad. The rules are the rules, and if you fall afoul of the law, you've got to pay a price. And maybe, you know, the whole thing needs to get, we need to come to a great, like this one set of rules that's applicable in every jurisdiction, and that's well and good. Just make sure that you're not breaking the rules. And the environmental contamination, you almost understand that argument where it came to the justifying the Jimson weed. But this one, I'm curious to hear the story of how dextromethorphan gets into a horse. Like, does the groom come up to give the horse a kiss? Go, and now that the horse has got that in his system, how does the horse test positive for that for some guy that's taken DayQuil or NyQuil or both or who knows what? It's such a, you know, it's such a weird thing, but absolutely. But these guys, I agree. I don't think Bob Baffert was looking for an edge. I don't think he's trying to cheat. And like Bob, like Bill said, this is not SGF 1000. This is something on a much more minor scale. But you gotta run a tight ship, and that's 100% the case.
Alan, is it true that NyQuil is going to sponsor the turf race next year, the Breeders' Cup Turf? Is it going to be the NyQuil Sleepy Time Turf Race?
I heard Brill Cream is going to sponsor it. Don't dabble, do you?
How old are you? Real cream.
Just following up on Al's point, I want to ask John, as someone who is presumably on the backside a little bit, he, you know, delegates to his underlings to actually go touch all the horses. But as someone who is theoretically on the backside a lot, how credible do you find these almost constant contamination excuses? Not just from Baffert, but everybody. That seems to be the go-to excuse for a lot of people when they fail a drug test.
Yeah, and Joe, that's actually a really good question. And I understand that the testing regiment is such that you're getting down to such a finite, literally a granule amount of a medication or an illegal substance that's coming up in some of these horses. And you wonder how that happens and how it doesn't happen to all of them. And, you know, if a groom is in a stall with a horse and coughs on it and that's why it's testing positive, again, we're it's hyperbole, but then as they're walking down the shed and coughing into their hand, and then they touch a saddle towel and that saddle towel is put on another horse, you wonder sometimes how all these horses don't get test positive if this is the sensitivity level of the testing. Now, the other thing that to look at is, you know, why is Bob Baffert getting kind of pulled out of this, when if you go on, you know, the website and you look up the other complaints, there are a lot of other trainers that are coming up with similar issues. And quite frankly, I think it goes back to the argument of, because Bob Baffert is the top of the industry, and no offense to a couple of these trainers, but nobody cares about Terso Limon or Kathy Walsh if their horses come up positive, for banned substances as well. You know, it's like if Alex Rodriguez, when he was playing, if he made an error, everyone jumped on top of him because it was A-Rod.
Well, and I think it's interesting too. And I agree with what Bill said before about how you shouldn't lump him in with Service and Navarro, because that was like a criminal conspiracy type thing where they're synthesizing drugs and like having a real edge. The stuff with Baffert is troubling, but I don't think it's on the same level. But the interesting thing about Service and Navarro was, Everybody with a cursory knowledge of racing, and especially the claiming game, knew that something was up, because they would claim horses off of other people and then move them up 10, 20, 30 points. Like, that kind of cheating, allegedly, seems extremely obvious to everyone who's looking. And honestly, that kind of is an indictment of the sport, that everyone else could see it and nothing happened about it for a long time. That aside, it's an interesting thing with Baffert, because, and other guys like that, like Chad Brown, because they get such good stock. They get the top of the top of the cream of the crop of the stock in the business. And you would think that they wouldn't need to cheat. At the same time, people look at them winning at 25, 26%, and they naturally have this inclination to think that these guys are cheating. Well, that's not necessarily the case. It might just be that they have such good stock, so few are scared of running against them, that, you know, they naturally have high win percentages. So, you know, Baffert's the kind of guy who's always going to have that cloud of suspicion around him, because he does win so many of these big races and because he does win at a high percentage. So I think if anything, that means he has to run a tighter ship than the normal guy. And he has to do an even better job than the regular, who doesn't have that kind of attention on him at all times.
One more thing about Baffert I'd like to say is, I think he's been getting some bad advice. You know, obviously, when something like this is very serious, he's got to be careful. I think he's relying a lot on advisors, particularly his lawyers. I think people are tired of "my dog ate my homework." And I think going forward, I think that has worked against him. You know, certainly has a right to defend himself, but I think he would have been better served by just, you know, not harping on these excuses and just saying, "It's my responsibility. This was wrong, and it's not going to happen again." I think he's gotten some bad advice. I think that has turned people off as well.
There's one other thing too. There's a link now, and the California Horse Racing Board is posting links to their documentation for lower class violations. So to think that's just Bob Baffert's in the world, and there are other names up there recognizable. John Sadler's name is up there a couple of times. Bob Hess Jr. is up there. And kudos to them for doing that. That sort of transparency is something that should be happening, maybe should have happened sooner than this. But so this is not just about Baffert phenomenon.
So lots of interesting thoughts there. I think we can all agree that at base, Baffert needs to be a better manager of his stable and the people who work for him. I think you know, at the end of the day, whether or not he was really trying to enhance the performance of his horses, you know, negligence is not necessarily a defense here, and it needs to get better for a guy who is so high profile and at the top of our sport. And like John said, with so many eyes on him. Coincidentally, when I tell people I'm in racing, they say, "Have you ever been to the Derby? And do you know John Green? What's he like?" I tell them he's most likely not a juicer, but I can't confirm for sure.
It didn't enhance my performance here, that's for sure.
So it wasn't just Gamine and Bob Baffert and Marinith in the news this week in relation to drugs. We also had a couple of headlines on the TDN that, even if you just read the headline, it's kind of funny / sad / kind of, I don't know, slapstick, I would say, for racing. First one is two odds on length of stretch winner, Charlestown winners DQ'd for class one positives. And then the other one was Iowa trainer testifies he accidentally spilled class one substance into feed. So this is kind of what we're dealing with now in racing. I think if this is your first time watching this podcast and you don't know that much about racing, like this is kind of what it's like. You know, we don't have these headlines every week, but we get these stories that trickle down to us, and you got to laugh sometimes. I mean, it's just, you know, racing has so many ridiculous, you know, drug stories and positive tests and all this. The Charlestown one is more interesting to me because the Iowa guy, first of all, it's kratom. So it's kratom is not like super toxic. A lot of people use it for opioid withdrawal. It's I mean, there's competing sciences depending on how beneficial or how harmful it is. And that, you know, that I could somewhat buy. It makes for a funny headline. But the Charlestown thing, the horse is won by 15 and a half lengths and 7.5 lengths and tested positive for fentanyl and eudolone, which is the drug stimulants. So if you remember those headlines of people like trying to eat faces off of other people, usually in Florida, that's what bath salts are. And that's what a horse was running on at Charlestown, allegedly, as well as fentanyl, which is like a billion times stronger than even heroin. So that one I find a little bit harder to believe that this was an accident. Supposedly that the explanation that they gave was that one of the grooms was on drugs and they asked him to do a drug test and he refused. So they suspended him, but no suspension for the trainer. So this was a trainer that shipped the horse, Tim Kreiser, who shipped the horse from Penn National to Charlestown into the barn of, what's this guy's name? Jack Hurley. And then the horse tested positive for these races at Charlestown. That's the most amazing part, is that the West Virginia Racing Commission had basically no punishment for this. And it's just, I'm going to read the quote for a second because it's pretty funny. It's it says the amount of fentanyl and eudolone found in the horse is a trace level. Who cares? It's fentanyl, which lends credibility to the probability that the horse was inadvertently exposed to the drug in some manner. Therefore, the standard penalty for a first offense class A medication violation, 1 year suspension / $10,000 fine, is not imposed in this manner. And it says he was being held accountable for the positive, and yet no punishment whatsoever. So the positive is on his record, but there's no fine, there's no suspension. To me, this is the problem. You know, these stories are going to pop up in racing, especially if environmental contamination is as prevalent as John, you know, and Bob Baffert's lawyers may argue. This is the kind of thing that's a problem, where there's no accountability, there's no punishment whatsoever. And it seems that the benefit of the doubt is given to trainers so much more often than it isn't. And I get it. Like, I get that, you know, you have to work with these people. You have to fill races. I get the logistical concerns of running a racetrack and carting races, but the horse tests positive for fentanyl and bath salts, and you're like, now we think that this guy is responsible, but we're going to let this one slide. Test positive for your horses on fentanyl and bath salts once, fool me once. You know, this is the kind of thing that you shouldn't need three strikes for.
You know, that famous story, you know, go on fentanyl once, shame on you. Go on fentanyl twice. I mean, it's what we've heard since we were kids, you know, just about the fentanyl. Jesus. How about the fact that for the year plus we've been doing this wonderful podcast, people have been complaining about us not, you know, being too New York centric and not regional enough. Well, here's a story for you, for West Virginia and for Prairie Meadow fans. You guys have positives also.
So, I mean, yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
No, go ahead, John.
I was just going to say that, yeah, this is, you know, there's a reason that we talk trash sometimes about tracks like Mountaineer and Charlestown. And it's like, it's not an offense to people who are doing the right thing and work at those racetracks. Listen, like wherever you can make a living in horse racing, God bless. But overall, these are the kind of things that come out of these tracks more often than great horses or great stories or any of that. And this is like, it's Mickey Mouse stuff. And we've seen a lot of that in racing at a lot of smaller tracks. You know, it's just, it's unfortunate. And you don't, like I said, you never really get any accountability for these kind of things. I think that is the big, you know, glaring problem that we have in racing is that, you know, at most you get a slap on the wrist. Like other than Rick Dutrow, what trainers have you seen get like a serious long ban or a fine or whatever, something that materially impacts their business? I 99% of the time, it's something like this, where it seems to me, I can't prove this, but it seems to me like the stewards and like the racing commissions kind of bend over backwards to take the word of the trainer with whatever cockamamie explanation they have for why their horse tested positive for fentanyl and bath salts. Like, you know, thank God that nobody cares about Charlestown, because, you know, Baffert gets all the headlines. You know, Joe Drape is banging on him in the New York Times all the time. And, you know, Bob Baffert has some stuff to explain as well. But this stuff, this is blaring red lights that makes our sport look completely ridiculous and like the Wild West. And, you know, accidents can happen. I'm sure that there is some kind of way where a horse could get accidentally contaminated and then just happen to win by 30 lengths. But it's strange credulity to think that this is a situation where there should have been no punishment whatsoever other than a hearing.
And the horse that won by 7.5 lengths at Charlestown, I think that is the length of the stretch at Charlestown, the way that racetrack is set up. Now, Bill Finley, I do have a bone to pick with you. You
okay. Are
in this modern day of racing, who constantly rails against horses not running enough, you did not even talk about the fact that this horse, Candy My Boy, that came up positive allegedly twice, ran twice within 8 days. That is the old school iron horse, you know, example of a horse running more often than not. I mean, I thought for sure you'd be like, at least the horse ran twice.
Hey, John, at least the horse ran twice in 8 days.
Thank you, Bill. That's the Bill Finley we know and love.
That's the only way.
I had two sort of tangent comments. Number one, like as a parent and as a manager, you teach your kids or your people that work for you to be responsible and take accountability. So I love the fact that there's zero accountability here, number one. And number two, I talked to my brother last night. He lives in Chicago, and he's a sports fan, but doesn't really know much about horse racing. And we talked for about 8 minutes about Bob Baffert. So again, it's the whole optics thing and how it's proliferated in general sports and just in society.
Yeah, I mean, it's you know, we joke about it. It's funny to me, like because like I said, it's slapstick comedy that all this, you know, these ridiculous headlines that you could only see in racing come out so frequently. But it's a serious problem. And like I said, thank God that nobody in the national media pays attention to Charlestown, because, you know, if racing were, you know, this is one of those situations where, you know, it's kind of a blessing in disguise that racing doesn't get that much national attention, because if this were baseball or football or whatever, you know, this would be a major story, like across the bottom of the ticker at the, you know, the lead of the ESPN ticker. But, you know, it gets to go under the rug because nobody cares. But, you know, we care. And you know, it's just the latest in a series of ridiculously bad headlines that only this sport, with its lax regulation and slaps on the wrist for violators, could produce. And there's no fear of accountability, I think, overall in racing. And I think that is one of the core problems in the sport. And hopefully it gets better with the Horse Racing Integrity and Safety Act and USADA getting involved, where there will be actual punishments. We're talking year-long, multiple-year suspensions, huge fines. You know, at the end of the day, there's it's just so toothless, the regulatory structure that exists in racing right now. And it's been that way for a long time. Hopefully it changes. But for now, we can laugh at it.
On you. Sorry, I didn't mean to jump on your conclusion.
Go ahead.
But I think it's really, I think you're right. I think it's twofold, though. I think one is that people can see that there's lax testing and that you can kind of get your way out of it sometimes. But the other thing is, I think a lot of trainers are under tremendous pressure to have to keep up with the Joneses and to also pay their bills. And when there are trainers in the industry that are cheating and winning races and basically taking food off their tables because they're because the alleged cheating trainers are winning races and the people who are doing the right thing are not winning as many races, it's got to be all kinds of pressure, you know, from your owners and for yourself and to pay your bills and to pay your employees and to have a chance to get better horses because you have a better winning percentage. So I think it's part of the, you know, part of the problem is that there are lax regulations in testing. And the other is that, you know, the people who are taking advantage of the system are winning a lot of races and winning a lot of money and therefore getting more and more horses. And I think it's just a cyclical issue where it's positive when they win and you get more horses and you keep going up the ladder. And when you don't win, it's negative and it keeps going down the tube. So, you know, these individuals are under all kinds of pressure. And I know we're kind of joking around a little bit about this stuff, but it's got to be really impossible for the honest trainers in the industry to continue to try to do the right thing time and time again when they're getting their heads handed to them by people who are not playing within the rules.
Yeah, I mean, it's yeah, that to me is the real serious part about it is that they're, first of all, beyond the animal welfare issue, that's the biggest concern. But then beyond that is, you know, taking money away and taking business away from trainers who are trying to do the right thing. And yeah, I'm laughing at the absurdity of the headlines, but it's really not funny, you know, when you take an overview of what this means for people who are trying to do the right thing in the sport. But yeah, just I love the the trainer is responsible, but there'll be no punishment. That's my favorite line. It's right. Just if you could sum up the toothlessness of racing commissions and stewards across the country with that one quote. I think that's it right there. Joining the West Point Thoroughbreds partnership can vault you into the world of instant camaraderie among people surrounding high-class horses and stakes action for a fraction of the cost to try and do it on your own. Learn more at westpointtb.com. So we do have we had our negative drug corner of the show, but now we want to shine a little bit of a positive light on a positive story because, you know, we do have these success stories in racing. Santa Anita wrapped up their autumn meet on Sunday, 16 days, no racing fatalities. They've had 5 racing fatalities this year overall from 5,069 starts, which is a fatality rate of under 1, which is kind of unheard of for dirt tracks. So I just want to give a hat tip and a shout out to Santa Anita because it seems like, you know, the reforms that they put in place from the winter of 2018 and 2019 when they had that epidemic of breakdowns have really paid dividends. And they deserve a lot of credit for that. You know, I think especially with, you know, the climate out in Santa Anita with all the wildfires and everything, they've been dealt just, you know, bad hand after bad hand. And they really have done, I think, as much as you could possibly do on this issue. You're never going to have a 0% fatality rate. But this is about as good as you can do when you're faced with the magnitude of crisis that Santa Anita was. So, you know, major shout out to Santa Anita for doing the right things and putting the horse first. And, you know, they deserve a lot of headlines. We harp on the headlines in racing, but this is one of the good ones. And one of the important ones is safety of the animal. And that undergirds pretty much everything that we talk about, negative and positive, you know, in terms of the broad scale issues in this podcast is that, you know, when we talk about drugs, it's mainly about animal welfare. And this is a shining example of how to protect the horses and credit to Santa Anita for sure. Guys.
And where is the press release from PETA acknowledging this and giving Santa Anita credit for having this sort of meet after ripping them to shreds over what has happened before? I'm not one to bash the media, but you know, the same people and news outlets and PETA and animal rights people that were so critical of Santa Anita before have been a deafening silence. And that's not fair.
Yeah. And again, some of the issues that occurred and the fatalities occurred previously, you can point to, maybe it was the record rains and all the issues they were having with, you know, with the racetrack. But the bottom line is that management stepped in and stepped up and did some things, you know, from a medication standpoint and from a racetrack management standpoint, and you know, really, you know, realized, took an introspective look and said, we need to fix this situation. And whatever the rationale and the reasoning was for why they had to come to the table and make decisions, it almost doesn't matter. They did. They stepped up and made different decisions and put money into the racetrack and put money into all the other issues that they felt they needed to be addressed. And the results are there. So kudos to them. And hopefully they will be, you know, a beacon of light for the rest of the industry to follow.
Yeah, like you said, Joe, even one death is one too many. But and to record a fatality rate that's less than one per 1,000 starters, and something like 400,000 training sessions. They haven't had a fatality dating back to the winter meet last year. So I think it's a tremendous result. I think there has to be an element of good fortune, as there is an element of bad fortune when these things happen. So I think there's that component. But listen, to report zero fatalities, even over a short period of time, is definitely something worth crowing about. Good for them.
Yeah, the numbers, just over 1,100 horses raced at the track during the meet. More than 51,200 training sessions were recorded, including 3,771 timed workouts over the main track, 487 over the training track since horses returned September 5th from Del Mar. So that's a lot of horses doing a lot. 16 days doesn't sound like a lot, but it really, there's so much training and racing that happens. Even in that short period of time, that it's hard to have a perfect safety record at any meet. So this is definitely something to be lauded and to be emulated as best as possible around the industry. So hats off to Santa Anita, and we hope that things continue in this positive direction over the upcoming winter meet. The New York Racetrack Chaplaincy Christmas Drive is now underway. Helps out the backstretch families at Belmont and Aqueduct. Check out more about it and why Michael Dubb decided to sponsor a family this Christmas.
In my time around the backstretch, it's been apparent to me that the backstretch chaplaincy is really part of the backbone of the racetrack and what they do for people, the care. There are no bounds, no limits to what they will do for the people of the backstretch in terms of improving their quality of life. And I fully intend to support their Christmas charity and their pledge and to support a family.
The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. With over 500 clients in the horse business, they have proven strategies to save you taxes. Learn more about how they can help you at www.greenco.com. So our Green Group Guest of the Week is a man who needs no introduction, but I'm going to do it anyway. The Eclipse Award of Merit winner, longtime columnist for The Washington Post, author of several seminal books on betting the horses, Andy Beyer, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So we thought it was a good time to have you on with the Breeders' Cup coming up and lots of huge issues going on in the racing industry. I'm sure you have lots of opinions, but I wanted to ask first personally about your personal betting habits. And you retired a couple of years ago. I was wondering if you bet more or less, if you bet differently than you used to, and why your habits have changed.
I bet much less. When I developed the figures and I was just about the only person, you know, who had speed figures, I had like as great an edge as a gambler could want from, say, the mid-70s to the mid-90s. And, now that that speed figures are common currency and everybody has access to them, you know, I don't have that edge. So it would be, you know, I made hay while the sun shined. in those golden years, but the figures don't give me that kind of an edge anymore. Plus, there are elements of the modern game that I just don't like. I mean, and at the top of the list, I think that the Rainbow Six and other copycat bets, with big jackpots that pay out to only one winner, have for me like killed the game in a lot of ways. I mean, there was nothing I used to like more, and got my juices flowing like a a big carryover in a traditional pick six. But the the jackpot bets are to me a sucker bet that fleeces the average player and was really created to benefit the big gambling syndicates that normal bettors can't compete with. So I'm down on that.
Hey, Andy, thanks for joining us. And speaking of the Breeders' Cup, there is at least one race where the buyer figures are going to really make a statement. And I think you know where I'm going with this, the Breeders' Cup Juvenile Fillies. Princess Nora on paper, and before anybody ever heard of speed figures, probably would have been overwhelming favorite. Wins her races easily, trained by Bob Baffert, exceptionally well-bred. But as you like to say, she's just plain slow. Could you tell us about Princess Nora, her figures, and how she stacks up? And is she a throw-up?
Well, I wouldn't go that far. I mean, you've got the best trainer in America, and you've got a horse who's been winning easily and can certainly improve, if she's forced to run harder, I guess. But I became a kind of aware of her when she ran in her last race. The commentators on TVG were just deriding the buyer speed figure, saying, how can this great horse only be getting figures in the 70s? Todd Schrupp, one of their commentators, mentioned her in the same breath with Ruffian, a sacrilege, I thought. But the fact is that, when I look at all of her races, the figures are solid as a rock. I mean, when she won her last race, the stakes at Santa Anita, there was a really weak group of male 2-year-olds, kind of going the same distance. And she was, you just had a direct line of comparison. And her time was very mediocre, and as were her other races. So, I mean, I always believe in standing by my figures when I can. And so I'll definitely be betting against her on the Breeders' Cup.
Andy, it's Jonathan Green. And one of my questions for you has to do with what you wrote in one of your four books, which talked about, the buyer numbers being raw speed figures and some of these other performance, tracking units, whether it's the sheets or Thoroughgraph or fill in the blank, are more considered performance figures. Could you give the audience just a quick tutorial on the difference between the buyer numbers being raw speed figures and the others that are, I will call copycats, that are more performance based?
I don't knock them. It's just a different philosophy. But when I started developing the figures, my feeling was I had to know accurately how fast the horse ran, and I felt that as a handicapper, I could and would deal with all the other figures. If a horse was 7 wide on a turn, I could know that. If there was a destructive pace in the race, I can look at the data and I can know that too. But I just had to have a number that resolved any ambiguity about who was faster than whom. And that's always been my philosophy. I mean, the thing is, I also feel that, I mean, I know that I can make figures accurately. I can express how fast a horse ran. When you're trying to evaluate, say, pace in a race, it's just trying to turn every other factor in racing into a number. I can't do it precisely, so I just want the speed figure that I believe in, and then I'll just take off and do my handicap.
And Andy, with the Breeders' Cup coming up and all these horses coming in from not only various racetracks in the United States, but also around the world, but let's focus on the United States racing. Is it fair to say that a horse that runs an 80 buyer in Santa Anita is comparable to an 80 buyer at Belmont, to an 80 buyer at Gulfstream?
Absolutely. I mean, when I started really getting into speed figures and gambling with them, this was my number one focus. I mean, I thought in the mid 70s, when you had Gulfstream Park or Hialeah as a magnet for horses all over the country, if I could know exactly that, you know, the shipper from New York was faster than the shipper from Churchill Downs, I would have a tremendous edge. And so, you know, ever since we've been doing numbers, that's been a big focus. Now we've got a computer to help us, and we are able to check shippers from track to track, very, very efficiently, and just, you know, say, show me all the horses shipping from Churchill Downs to Gulfstream and how their figures compared in each place. So it would, if we find tracks that are out of line, we'll make adjustments in the figures. But this has always been one of the things that are at the heart of the buyer speed figures.
Hey, Andy, it's Alan Carrasso, and it's really great, really great to speak with you. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks. You're welcome.
I'm a Princess Noor backer, so okay. Now I'm going to do so with trepidation, but I'm going to leave it right there.
As I said earlier, I mean, she's got the best trainer in America. I mean, a horse who wins that easily, can always step up. When people make that argument, well, she won so easily, she'll run much faster than she has to, it's more often than not wrong. I'll just go with the numbers. But
right.
I wish you luck, but don't bet too much.
I wanted to ask you about the evolution of your figures. Back 20 years ago, it wasn't uncommon to see the formal golds and skipaways and go sappers earn figures north of 125. And those are a thing of the past these days. A top figure these days is maybe Flincher got a 116 for the Joe Hirsch 1 year or something like that. But yeah. What's led to sort of pulling back on those numbers? Why don't horses run as fast?
We have kind of measurements to make sure that or to try to ensure that the numbers mean, you know, the same thing over time. I mean, it's a tricky thing to do, but we had Frosted running a figure of 123, we had Arrogate of 122. It's just that, you know, there aren't as many performances like that. I think it's not because of, you know, the mechanics of the figures, but just changes in the game. Horses don't run as much as they used to. They're retired sooner. So you don't get, horses with 30 race careers who have plenty of opportunities to run giant figures. And, horses aren't pushed as hard as they were. And I think there has just been perhaps a general decline in the breed. But as I say, I don't read this as as an indictment of the figures. I say one more thing, and particularly in the most high profile races, the Triple Crown, the winning speed figures in like the Kentucky Derby and the other races are much lower than they used to be. But look how horses are campaigned. Used to be they'd come into the Derby like with 20 races behind them. Those tough old horses are of yore. Now now we have top contenders coming into the Derby with four races behind them. They're not going to run a figure of 110, with that kind of preparation. So that's another one of the issues.
Right. And I didn't mean, that wasn't to suggest that I was indicting the figures at all. I was just curious, for him, and maybe I just asked the question.
No, I'm curious, it's all right. Because we worry about that too, but I think, we want the figures to be right historically, and I think they are, but it's a tricky, it's a tricky thing to get exactly right.
I wanted to broaden the discussion a little bit. You wrote your books when you were in your early 30s. I think my $50,000 year at the races, you're the same age that I am right now. I wanted to ask about how, I think that those books actually did a really good job marketing the game to younger people, young professionals. And I think that's something that racing does a pretty poor job of now. Do you have any ideas, or do you have any kind of concept of why racing has failed to recruit these younger generations of bettors now? And if there's anything that racing could do better?
Well, there's so many gambling opportunities now. And, when you look at the wide, availability of sports betting, of, online everything, it's just a competitive marketplace out there. And, racing with its high takeouts, the specter of, kind of illegal drugs that might undermine people's confidence in the integrity of the game. I think that somebody looking, objectively at different gambling options and saying, what do I want to put my money on? Might not view horse racing as the best gamble around. Still is my favorite gamble after about 50 years, but not everybody feels that way.
Hey, Andy, you just brought up the whole idea of the legal drugs, and that's why we wanted to go with this. You've been railing against this longer and louder than perhaps anybody else, talking about the juice guys, et cetera. Since we last spoke to you or since you retired, a major change has come about or appears to be coming about with USADA at some point in time looking to take over the drug testing and the policing of the sport. Do you have any confidence that this will make things better?
Well, I think we have. And I think there was a great revelation this year with the criminal cases against Jason Service and Jorge Navarro. I'm going to say, in all the years that I was writing about the super trainers and, guys whose performance just seemed to defy logic, I had the notion that, you would have a cheating trainer and a cheating veterinarian, and so they juice up their horses and win races, and I thought, well, the industry is just looking the other way. The stewards aren't cracking down. We learned from the case earlier this year that it's not as simple as that. I mean, the conspiracy this year, I mean, this was a major criminal conspiracy, people, manufacturing sophisticated drugs, hiding the presence of those drugs in a sophisticated way. It took a year-long investigation by the FBI with wiretaps, to nail the cheaters. And this was just not, like a sneaky trainer and a sneaky vet. I mean, this is something that needed, made a major law enforcement effort. And so I was just kind of wrong about what was happening. And I think the only answer is, to controlling this problem is to bring in kind of high powered investigators to enforce it. I mean, the industry itself, it wasn't negligence. They just didn't have the we just didn't have the tools to keep the cheaters at bay.
Andy, just as a follow-up to Bill's question, so when you're analyzing, you know, the speed figures and you see horses that are improving in leaps and bounds when they go to a new barn, whether it's through a claim or through a transition to a new trainer, and not naming names, but are there still trainers out there that you still have red flags up?
Sure, sure. And, you know, what if I'm looking at a new track, the first statistic I look at is the major trainers, what is their winning percentage off a claim? And then look at those horses. And when you see somebody who consistently moves horses up, in their speed figures, when they get a new horse, that's the calling card. I love there was in the news just last week, there was a horse who ran at Charlestown, with not much form, and it happened that he just went to the barn of a leading trainer there, and the horse won by 17 lengths and improved his speed figure by 40. And they say, "Oh, I guess we gave him the wrong medication." The improvements are tremendous, and if you're handicapping almost anywhere in the country, you've got to be aware of the impact of the super trainers.
Andy, many of your fellow speed makers have a European component. The Sheets have started to do some European figures, and Timeform has a European base. Are European figures anything that you've ever considered touching?
I have always had the a goal of doing speed figures in a foreign country, and and being the king of Argentina gambling or the king of Australian gambling. There are a couple places where I felt I was close to competence, but it's just too tough. And since most of the world is is focused on turf racing, I mean, turf presents just a whole different array of challenges because of the widely differing pace scenarios in grass races. You watch horses in England, gallop around in slow motion for 3/4 of a mile or whatever before they turn them loose in the stretch. I mean, what does final time mean under those circumstances? I'm not sure I know. I mean, the only place that I was that I made speed figures that out of the U.S. where I was fairly confident was in Argentina. I spent a few weeks in Buenos Aires. I liked the figs. Unfortunately, it was like a 28% takeout. The racing data was terrible. And, I put in a year of effort and, never cashed a meeting for that.
Been there. So one last question for me, at least. I know you're not super up to date with this Breeders' Cup. I know you have a couple opinions, though, because you're a horse player. Horse players always have opinions. Other than betting against Princess Noor, who do you like in this Breeders' Cup?
I tell you the one other horse I'm really rooting against is Maximum Security. I just think that for this horse to win, to be America's biggest race or to become a champion, to have him be the poster boy for American racing when he was part of the worst drug scandal in history. Any other result on the weekend will be tolerable for me, but please don't let him win.
Yeah, we were talking about that last week about how Horse of the Year voters might have to take that into account, even if he wins.
I think that might be a little bit of a factor, yes.
Bill,
I'm sorry. Hey, Andy, switching gears once again. About a month and a half ago, I was talking a lot to you and Randy Moss about the problems the figures were having because of this GMAX system. As people aren't familiar, though I'm sure they are, it's a GPS system that is put in by Equibase at several racetracks in the country. And you guys were finding that it just wasn't accurate. The whole thing is sort of quieted down. Equibase put out a press release at one point sort of saying, yeah, we know what's going on. We'll look into it. Bring us up to speed. Are you still having problems with this? What's the latest?
Well, we don't trust the published figures at all, and we're spending an inordinate amount of effort, timing races, the races at their tracks ourselves. I mean, Randy Moss was really kind of ahead of almost everybody on this, developed methods using very sophisticated video editing software where we can in most cases clock the races accurately. But I the Equibase people will feel that they can improve things. We'll have two transmitters instead of one in the saddle cloth and this and that. But I just think that the problems are inherent, to the GPS system. It's not, it's just not precise enough for the data that we need in racing. I would draw on my experiences as a frequent user of Uber to go to restaurants, and you take a restaurant an Uber to a location, the driver finds an obscure street, he gets there, and they say, and then says, now where's the restaurant? Where's the sign? Getting that last 10 or 20 feet. Is something that the GPS doesn't really pinpoint, and I think that's that's the key problem. I mean, it's just not precise in an area where we need absolute precision. I mean, to be wrong by 2/5 of a second on the time of a race, destroys any attempt to do speed handicapping or make speed figures.
All right, Andy, thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for your insights over the years. Okay. And your voice.
My pleasure, guys.
But you enjoy your retirement and appreciate you taking some time with you.
Take it easy. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Good luck in the Breeders' Cup.
Okay.
The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. As this week's Green Group Guest of the Week, Andy Beyer will receive a free one-hour tax consultation. Learn more about how they can help you at www.greenco.com. We'll be right back after this message from The Green Group.
The Green Group is widely recognized as the top-rated tax and accounting firm specializing in the horse business. Why do the top owners, breeders, pinhookers, and trainers trust The Green Group as their tax advisors? The difference is experience. Firm founder Len Green has over 4 decades of experience owning, breeding, and racing horses. First-hand knowledge gives Green Group clients proven tax and money-saving strategies. Visit The Green Group at www.greenco.com. The Green Group, proven strategies to save you taxes.
All right, so that's going to do it for this week's edition of the TDN Writers Room presented by Keeneland. Remember, Keeneland November starts November 9th, 2 days after the Breeders' Cup World Championships at Keeneland Racecourse. I want to thank Bill Finley, John Green, Alan Carasso, our Green Group Guest of the Week, Andy Beyer, our producer, Patty Wolf, and our editors, Danny Seiper and Aaliyah LaRocca. Thank you for watching. Wear a mask. We'll see you next week.